Hi, I'm Leah Lane, an award-winning travel writer and author of Places I Remember, Tales, Truths, Delights from 100 Countries. On this podcast, we share conversations with travelers about fascinating destinations and memorable experiences around the world. On Places I Remember, we talk about destinations, travel stories, and themes. Today, we'll be combining all three in a memorable episode. The United Nations General Assembly designated January 27th, the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau, as International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The UN urges us to honor the 6 million Jewish victims of the Holocaust in Europe and millions of other victims of Nazism in the 1930s and 40s, and to develop educational programs to help prevent future genocides. Our podcast is Places I Remember, so to heed their call, we'll first discuss a few of the most important of the many sites, museums, and memorials to honor those who suffered. And in the very special second part of the podcast, we'll talk to Alan Hall, who survived the Holocaust as a child, hiding with his family in Poland. It's so important to educate ourselves about what happened during this time and during other genocides before and since to understand so that we can avoid the horrors in the future, as well as honor the victim. You can read about the Holocaust and see photos and films, but traveling to sites, museums, and memorials is the ultimate way to bear witness. Here are a few you might consider visiting. In 1965, 20 years after the concentration camps were liberated, I traveled to Dachau concentration camp outside of Munich, Germany. Germans who had lived through the war were walking by the photos in a new museum there, shaking their heads in seeming disbelief. I've also been to the Buchenwald concentration camp outside of Weimar, Germany, and to the most famous and most awful site of all, Auschwitz, near Krakow, Poland. Auschwitz I was the building holding political prisoners. Auschwitz-Birkenau was a combination of a concentration camp and an extermination camp, which held predominantly Jews, as well as homosexuals and gypsies. The scale of the camp is huge, with a long train track upon arrival and remaining structures scattered over a vast area. An organized tour will include an expert guide with transport between the different parts of the camp. At Auschwitz-Birkenau, most of the infamous gas chambers were destroyed by the Nazis when they learned that they had lost the war, and the crematoria are mostly piles of rubble. Other parts remained intact, such as the barracks with stacked wooden shelves where people slept, three on a shelf. Auschwitz also features exhibitions of inmates' possessions, such as hair and millions of shoes. At Auschwitz-Majdanek, a separate site, much less has been destroyed. This is located within suburban Krakow, overlooking flats and residential homes. I had worked as a ghostwriter with an Auschwitz survivor in the 1980s and went to pay respects by visiting the barracks where she had lived. In 1995, 50 years after the liberation, I walked alone in Auschwitz on a late afternoon and could feel the presence of the lost millions of murdered innocent men, women, and children. Many museums and memorials around the world offer exhibits. The Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. is one. And my son, Carrie, curates exhibits at the Kupferberg Holocaust Center in Queens, New York. At the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, thousands of concrete slabs over 6 feet high and positioned like dominoes at different levels give perspective to the turbulence and uncertainty of those times. The memorial is a place of contemplation, remembrance, and also warning. Some of you may have seen the movie Schindler's List. Oskar Schindler was a German businessman living in Krakow, Poland. You can visit the factory where he employed Jews, offering them protection from the Nazi Party's hunt. The Nazis actually knew that he was employing them, but he had a good relationship with the SS and claimed he needed them because they cost less for their labor and were necessary for the German war effort. As a result, thousands upon thousands of Jews who worked in his factory avoided being transported to extermination camps, and the factory has been turned into a museum. In Jerusalem, you'll find Yad Vashem, which translates the hand of God. It's a living tribute and memorial to the victims of the Holocaust who did not receive a burial. The exhibits feature photographic accounts written and spoken by victims, remains from survivors, art installations, and information panels. And there's a side dedicated to children of the Holocaust, which is completely in the dark. Ghettos were segregated areas where Jewish people were forced to live under Nazi occupation. Warsaw in Poland was home to the largest and deadliest Nazi-cultivated ghetto in Europe. At its highest capacity, it housed almost 400,000 people, which works out to about 8 people per room. This was the site of the Warsaw Uprising when Jews fought the Nazis in a desperate and futile attempt to overthrow them. Today, you can visit the site and the footbridge of memory, the bridge which links two smaller ghettos. Pictures of the victims are displayed on the buildings as you walk the streets. In the heart of Amsterdam, Anne Frank's house is where the now legendary Anne and her family lived in hiding during World War II to avoid persecution. Living with them, there was a family called the Van Pels and later a dentist named Pfeffer. Anne Frank's now famous diary, written during her time in hiding, documents her thoughts and feelings as a budding teenager, at times surprisingly and endearingly hopeful. Tragically, the group was betrayed and transferred to concentration camps. Anne died in Bergen-Belsen in 1945, just days after she found her sister Margot had died of disease and near the war's end. Her diary was discovered and published by her father Otto, the only member of the group who survived the Holocaust. Anne Frank's house in Amsterdam is now a hugely popular museum. Visitors are able to see the bookcase where they lived behind, walk through the cramped secret annex, and the museum has collected objects and photographs which belong to the family, and Anne Frank's original diary is on display. I remember visiting in 1965, before the modern building that houses artifacts was constructed, and before the crowds. We could walk right up the stairs to the secret annex and walk into the premises in silence. Like Anne Frank, our guest Alan Hall was a child hiding with his family during the Holocaust. His is a remarkable story of resourcefulness, bravery, and luck, and we are honored and grateful that he joins us to share his story. Welcome, Alan, to Places I Remember.
It's good to be with you.
So, Alan, you were born in Krakow, Poland in 1935, and as you wrote, you led a charmed life until the Nazis marched into Poland. Before we talk about what you endured for years, please first share with us some memories of your life as a child in Krakow before the troubles began.
I remember we lived in a very nice apartment on the same block down the street. My grandparents lived and my aunt. And I was the prince. I was the firstborn child. I was the only child. I was the only grandchild. I was the only nephew. And whatever I wanted, I could have. And life was good. My mother was a professional musician, and my dad was a insurance executive. We lived a very nice upper middle class life.
Now, you were 6 years old in June 1941 when the Germans attacked the Soviets and occupied Eastern Poland. Soon you were forced to wear a yellow star on your clothing publicly, declaring you were Jews. Please give us a brief idea of what happened to your family when the horrors first began, and when did you first feel it?
We didn't understand what was happening, and the Germans were very good at not letting people know. For example, we got a little 3x5 card saying that we have to leave our apartment and everything in it and go and move to another apartment. We could only take one suitcase with us, one small suitcase. When we got to the other apartment, we were so surprised. There was another family there. Shortly thereafter, a third family moved in. We had no idea. We actually voluntarily or under duress moved into the ghetto. We did not know. We never heard of a ghetto. So that gives you some idea of how things went. Once in a ghetto, the horrors started immediately. Abuse on the street, people dying in the street, no food. My dad was able to maintain his job, so he could come and go. And we were able to get a little bit of food on the black market.
Well, you were under siege by local anti-Semitic laws, as you mentioned, and seeking safety, you write that you walked over 200 miles to Lvov, Poland. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
What happened there?
Well, that's where that was 1939. And the first thing that breaks down in a war zone is public transportation. There were no buses, no trains, no airplanes. And so we had the only choice that we had to do to get away from the Germans is to walk across the country and find a ferry across the river. None of us could swim. And we wound up by sheer happenstance to Lvov, which was under Soviet control. That bought us 20 months of life.
Now, you write that you were the first child picked up in the children's program there. Could you tell us more about that, please?
Yes, I was very, very lucky. My dad was forewarned by a police officer that there was going to be a children's pogrom. We never heard of such thing. I was on my way to a safe house out in the country, and the street was closed off, blocked off right in front of us. And since I was on the street, on the sidewalk, I was the low-hanging fruit, and I was the first one apprehended by the Nazis, put in the back of a truck. They fanned out into the apartment blocks, wrestled children away from their parents. And you can imagine the crying and screaming. Brought them on down to the truck, and when the truck was full, it took us to a concentration camp. All of those children, except for myself, I suspect, died. My dad walked right in there, spoke brilliant German. He was educated in Vienna, and like a pedophile, said, "How much for one of these children?" Not identifying me. He was given a price. He went back, gathered the amount of jewelry, diamonds, and gold that was requested, came back, and literally bought me. And we walked out of there. I am sure to this day that I'm only one of those maybe 200 or 300 children that's alive.
Well, so the Germans took the jewelry and let you go. Where did you go after that?
I rejoined my parents, and immediately we started hiding, at first within the ghetto, in an attic above a theater, subsequently in the basement below a factory. Subsequently, we realized there is no safety in the ghetto, and my parents got a false ID papers showing that we were Christians rather than Jews, and we snuck out of the ghetto and started hiding in the Christian side of the community.
And what happened then?
Well, life was not easy. One of our landladies turned us in, and policemen came and took us to the Gestapo headquarters. The Germans were not even interested to find out whether or not I was Jewish. They could have easily found out by just checking whether I was circumcised. Only Jews were circumcising their boy babies. And they just said, take them across the street to the what they call the Umschlagplatz, which is the railroad station across the street from Warsaw Ghetto. Actually, abutting the Warsaw Ghetto. From there, the trains went to Treblinka. I was very lucky because I was so active and the place was so busy. They took me out of there and took me to an orphanage in the Warsaw Ghetto.
And how long were you there?
About 3 weeks, and a man showed up wearing a uniform. I didn't trust anybody, least of all someone in uniform, and said, "I'm here to take you to your parents." There was no way in the world that I was going to go with him. But he spoke to the adults in the orphanage, and they literally took me outside, locked the door behind, and I was stuck outside with this man I didn't trust. He put a cap on my head, pulled the brim way down, said, "Whatever you do, don't look up, don't let go of my hand, and don't say a word." We walked right up to the German station where they're guarding the ghetto. And the guard said, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" He said, "I'm a trolley car conductor. Look at my uniform. And I'm here to show him. I want you to brought my son to show him what the Jews look like." And they said, "You're stupid. It's almost curfew. Run home, because if they catch you on the street after curfew, they shoot on sight. And pray that you can get home in time." And that's how I got out of Warsaw Ghetto. He delivered me to my parents. And till this day, I would like to say thank you to him for saving my life. He was obviously a Christian, but I never could find him. Did not know who he was.
That you're honoring him today. We can think of him with honor. Now, your father changed his appearance as one of the ways to hide in plain sight. You were reunited with your family, and he did something very bold. How did he change his appearance? What did he have to do?
Well, he went to see a physician, a doctor. Those days, they still carry the little black bag. And he pointed to his nose and he said, "This is my death warrant. Give me a rhinoplasty, a nose job." The doctor said, "You know, I can't take you to the hospital. The Jews are forbidden from any hospital." And so my dad said, "Well, why don't you just do it at home? You've got your little black bag." He said, "I can't do that. I don't have an assistant. I don't have an anesthetic. I don't have a full array of tools." My dad then said, "You know, my wife is solely dependent upon me. And if I die, she will die also." Well, the doctor said, "Now, you know me. You know I would like to do it, but I can't." And then my dad placed his ace card. He said, "I've got a 7-year-old son." I was 7 by then. "And if you don't do it, my son has no chance to live." All that was true. And so finally, the doctor kind of wavered and gave up. He said, "Come to my house." And so that night, my dad came to his house with a half a bottle of vodka. That was his sole anesthetic. And he literally assisted the physician in a rhinoplasty on his nose. And the job was brilliant because while he was not a pretty outcome and he never looked Jewish, he looked more like a retired boxer with a flat nose, no bridge on the nose at all.
And it got him through. Another person also, who helped get you through.
Also, he dyed his hair blonde. And he, since he spoke brilliant German, high German, he could socialize with Nazis. Nobody ever suspected.
Well, he did something extremely bold and risky in the epicenter of the Nazis. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I assume they were having beers. They were socializing. A German was complaining that he had an office in a Nazi headquarters building, the tallest building in Poland, second tallest building in Europe, and he was just paying rent for an office he could not use. Well, my father almost jumped out of his shoes, and he said, "Well, I've got a little factory. We could probably use that space. How much you own for it?" A price was established, and my dad sublet that office in a Nazi headquarters building. We climbed up the 13 flights of stairs up to that because we would not use the elevator since it was, these were manual elevators run by operators. And so we climbed up the back stairs, got into that office. And for the next 2 years, my mother and I were hidden in a back closet in the back in the private, off the private office in the Nazi headquarters building in Warsaw.
Tell me about the closet.
Well, the closet was about 2 feet, 2.5 feet wide, or deep, I should say, and about maybe 4.5 to 5 feet wide. My mother and I sat on the floor facing each other, and we each had a pillow on our lap so that because there were people working all around us, so we had to cough, sneeze, or anything, we would bury our heads in the pillow. The only other things that we had in the closet were a potty for personal needs, and lastly, a little bit of white string, like a baker's string, and we would play cat in the cradle for hour after hour after hour. And that's the way we spend about 9 to 10 hours each day, 5 days a week. And even on Saturdays, Sundays, when we come out of the closet, we could never rise above the bottom of the window so that nobody would see us.
How many years did you have to do this?
2 years.
2 years.
But for us, this was heaven because nobody apprehended us. And this was 2 years of safety. It just, frankly, for us, it didn't get any better.
How did you eat? What did you eat?
Well, again, my dad would come and go, and he would buy food on the black market. And occasionally, when that was not possible, the top two floors were occupied by Nazis' Air Force headquarters for the country of Poland. That was a 24/7 operation. They would sometimes throw food out that they didn't like. They would throw potato peelings that they didn't like, and even some rotten potatoes. And that was one of the principal food sources for us.
You write something I can't forget. You wrote that you were only a child, but from mid-1941 until mid-1945, you don't remember crying, not even once. Is that because you were afraid?
Right. Well, because crying, there's two things about crying. It makes noise. People look at you and people notice somebody's crying. And I passed for those 4 years by not being noticed, by not being seen. So crying was off limits. No matter how bad I felt, no matter how much pain I experienced, crying was off limits.
Now, in the midst of all this, to get money to buy food, your mother created something very exceptional. What did she figure to do?
Well, my dad whittled crochet hooks out of the parquet flooring, and we started knitting shopping bags out of paper string, which dad created, which they colored in some very pretty colorful ways. And we would sell those for maybe use $5, $6. And so they were sold very readily. And that was, if you had a bag full of groceries and these things could hold a good bit of weight, they're made out of this paper string. It's still available even here in the United States. But if you got caught in the rain, well, you know what happens to paper when it gets wet. And so he had to be careful not to sell in the same part of Warsaw these bags. So every time he sold somewhere else. And once or twice he had close call.
Right. Amazing. Well, tell us about April 1943. What happened then? The Warsaw Ghetto uprising.
Well, we could hear and we could smell the Warsaw uprising. But our windows, on the we were on the 13th floor of this high-rise building, they faced in another direction. And so if we snuck up and just peeked over the windowsill, we could see them 13 floors below, the Nazis forming columns to go into the ghetto to kill the Jews. But we could never see anything pertaining to the ghetto fighting itself. And I think looking at it in retrospect, that was a blessing, because that was a never-ending horror that lasted probably for almost a month. And every day when we heard the explosions and gunfire, we thought each day just the fact that they were still fighting was a huge victory. But the end was foreseeable.
Well, this is all tying into what I was talking about in the beginning of the sites we can still visit today. And you're telling us the history which goes behind it, which I'm very thankful that you're here to share these moments with us. Let me just ask you, there was a surprise in September 16th, 1944. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that was a big surprise.
Big surprise.
Big surprise. We were all middle, was swollen because of malnutrition and hunger. And we were forced to go down to the bomb shelter because this was during the Warsaw Uprising, the Polish Uprising, not the ghettos. This long after the ghetto was gone. And we, under sniper fire, had to go to another bomb shelter. And there, for the first time, they separated my mother and I. She was maybe only 30 or 40 feet away. And they dropped a sheet between us. And she knew immediately I'd be terrified, which I was. And she would reassure me from the other side of the sheet. Nevertheless, several hours later, I heard what I thought was a cat screeching. And what I didn't, I never had been around babies. What I didn't realize is that these were the birth cries of my baby brother, who was born in 1944, September of 1944. I thought his birth was my death, because now there was no way to go unnoticed. So I was not the happiest person to see him, but I'm coming to this world. I was completely wrong, because a physician, we had to, in order to get out of Warsaw, which by that time was being destroyed by the Germans, we had to go through a checkpoint. Well, we couldn't, because we were sitting in a closet for 2 years previously, and we had no papers. So we wouldn't have been shot on the spot. But a doctor, in order to save this baby, put us in a hospital train, wrapped up my mother's face in bandages as though she was hit by shrapnel. And we went off thinking that the train would go to Germany. But in fact, surprise of surprises, the train went back to Krakow, the very place where we started. So my brother was the cause of our survival. And once we're in Krakow, my dad established a relationship with the Polish underground, and they gave us shelter for the last 4 months of the war.
Did you realize you were just outside of Auschwitz extermination camp while you were living there?
Absolutely not. The Germans never let anybody know about anything like that. Interestingly, the Allies knew more about the concentration camps than we did. Every time they took people, they said they're going to further east to a place where they could work. So a lot of people got on these trains willingly. No, we knew nothing about the concentration camps. We knew all we knew was that once the Germans got you, we never heard from that person again. And that's all we knew. We had no idea about the killings.
Well, on January 19th, 1945, you write that your father came home and announced the Russians have liberated Krakow, the Nazis are gone. And when the war ended, your father was arrested. And knowing the children would be used as hostages, your mother instructed you to take the baby and make your way to Palestine. So for months, you write that you were hunted by the Soviets, and you were 11 years old, carrying your baby brother across Europe, trying to get to Italy and a ship to Palestine. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. After the war, we always thought that the Soviets were our liberators. They were the good guys. We had no idea what they really were like. My dad was very fortunate. He got a job in the Polish government in a very high position. And he did not understand the conflict between East and West. And so he traveled West to try to establish relationships with insurance companies to bring him into Poland so as to enhance the economic development of Poland, because after the war, it was devastated. Well, he made too many trips to the West. And one night there was a knock on the door. There's a banging on the door. And they came in and arrested my dad and dragged him off to prison. After maybe 6 weeks, a while, they told him he was being sent to Siberia, which he was. Mom knew that he was going to try to attempt to escape. And she sent my brother, who at that time was about 20 months old, and me, walking across Europe to Trieste. And from there, the ships went to Palestine to sneak people in. And so with my brother on my back, that's what we did. We went usually each day from maybe 10 to 25 miles walking. Sometimes got a ride. And we went from one DP camp to another. And we never went alone. We always had to go with a group. And so we got about as far as Baden, which was just about 40 miles south of Vienna. And there my brother got sick. He wound up in the hospital. He was there for about a month. Mom and dad, in fact, did escape from a Soviet prison. And my mother joined him, and they went off to Paris. They started looking for us. Well, by that time, I was an expert in invasion. So there were no DP, there were no papers. So every camp I went into, I changed my name. And so when they tried to track us down, they couldn't. And finally, the only way they could track us down is by describing two kids traveling together, one about 2 years old and one about 11. And the old one could be a boy and a girl because we had no hair. So I could just slip on a dress and I could identify myself as female. And the younger one, probably a little boy because he couldn't understand changing genders. Well, they visited a number of pairs of children and finally found us that way.
Well, the story, as I will tell you later, is available on the show notes so you can hear more about it and read more about it. But I'll just say that in 1947, your family immigrated to the United States and you were 12 years old and unable to read or write, you say in your book, and you didn't speak a word of English. And you began school and you went on to graduate from the University of Florida and the University of Florida Law School. And you married and had three daughters and a successful life. But how did it feel when you first came to America?
My first view of America was on an airplane. And I came out of the darkness of Europe because Europe was pretty much still. I had very few lights, even after 1946, 47. Actually, this was became here in January of 47. And so I came at it from the darkness and I looked out the window of the airplane and I saw this sea of light. I just couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like it. And I was amazed. Of course, what I was looking at was the skyline of New York. And so that was my introduction to America. And really and truly, that was a very nice metaphor, a very nice example of what I experienced here. I came from darkness to light.
Absolutely. In 1993, you revisited Warsaw with your family. What did it feel like returning there?
Well, we visited several times. The only time I ever broke down was I visited with my brother and his family, my family, my mother. My dad had died previously. And we actually were at the door of the closet, of the room where we hid for 2 years in the closet. And there, for the first time and the only time, I absolutely lost it. I'm teary when I talk to you about it now. I can't explain to you, but there is something really terrific about that space. And that is, this was a space for us which was as uncomfortable as it might have been. It was heaven, sitting in a closet and not being apprehended, not being fearful of being apprehended every moment. Even though food was short and all the rest of it, it was still heaven. I revisited that place in 2018. That same building has been rehabbed completely. It is now the Warszawa, Polish word for Warsaw, Hotel. It is the most plush, the most opulent, the nicest hotel I've ever seen on any continent. The very space where I hid of course, it's been totally reconfigured, but now is a grand suite.
Unbelievable.
Yes. And it, you know, I say this with a smile on my face because it's ironic, but it's just kind of wonderful for me.
Yes.
To see that space.
Well,
and fortunately, if we survive COVID, etc., I want to go back to the hotel and I want to check into that space just to satisfy myself.
Absolutely. Unbelievable. Alan, thank you so very much for sharing your amazing story. There are many stories from many survivors. Each one is unique. Each one teaches us so much. You can click on the link in Alan's bio on this episode's show notes to download Alan's Holocaust memoir, Hiding in Plain Sight. I highly recommend doing it. And also, if you're on Twitter, please consider following at Auschwitz Museum. And each day on the birthday of a survivor, you can read about that person and see their photo. And you will realize that they were people just like us, living their lives like Alan. And we must never forget. So thank you again. I really appreciate your coming.
Thank you. And I just want to point out that the memoir can be downloaded free of charge.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
It's good to be with you.
You too.
Thanks for listening to our award-winning podcast. We've recorded over 100 episodes of Places I Remember. So follow us on any podcast app. And new monthly episodes are also on YouTube with gorgeous video. My book, Places I Remember, is available in print and Kindle, and I read the audio version. Follow my travel writing at Forbes.com. Contact me at the links in the show notes or on my website, placesiremember.leahlane.com, and keep making your own travel memories.